The glare from Pasha. The ones who braved the glare earned something else. A touch of her Han. They yelped from the invisible pinch and made themselves scarce. Richard understood now why the palace was breeding wizards. They were trying to get one with additive and subtractive magic. And now, they had one. They walked silently up into the hills, bathed in the golden light of the late afternoon sun. Richard felt better out in the open, rocky hills overlooking the city. Though it was an illusion, he felt free. He suddenly wished Pasha weren't along. He hadn't come out to see Gratch in days. Gratch was probably frantic. He was at a loss as to what he was going to do next. He didn't know if everything the prelate had said was true, and he didn't know which he feared more, that it was a lie or the truth. Pasha's hand on his arm tightened in a way that brought him out of his brooding thoughts and made him draw to a halt. She glanced about nervously. He could tell by the way she was breathing through her mouth that she was frightened. "What's wrong?" he whispered. Her gaze searched the surrounding rocks.
"Richard, there is something out here. Please, let's go back."
Richard drew the sword. Its unique ring filled the still afternoon air. He felt nothing, no sense of danger, but Pasha's Han obviously felt something that frightened her. Pasha let out a little shriek. Richard spun. Gratch's head poked up above a rock. Pasha backed away. "It's all right. He won't hurt you." Gratch gave a tentative grin, showing his fangs as he stood to his full towering height.
"Kill it!" she screamed. "It's a beast! Kill it!"
"Pasha, calm down. He won't hurt you." She backed farther away. Gratch stood looking from Richard to Pasha, not knowing what to do. Richard realized she might use her power to hurt the Gar, so he put himself between the two.
"Richard, move! It must be killed! It's a beast!"
"It won't hurt you! I know him, Pasha." She turned and ran, her violet cloak flying behind. Richard groaned as he watched her leap from the top of one rock to another, making her way down the hill. He scowled back at Gratch.
"What's wrong with you? Did you have to scare her? What are you doing showing your face to people?"
Gratch's ears wilted. His shoulders slumped, and he began to whine. When his wings started quivering, Richard went to him.
"Well, it's too late now to be sorry. Come on and give me a hug."
Gratch cast his eyes to the ground. "It'll be all right." He put his arms around the big furry creature. Gratch finally responded. He threw his arms and wings around Richard, gurgling his happiness. In a moment, he pulled Richard off the rock and wrestled him to the ground. Richard tickled his ribs and wrestled until Gratch was giggling in glee. After they had settled down, Gratch put a claw tip in the pocket where Richard kept the lock of Kaelin's hair. He looked at Richard from under hooded eyebrows as big as axe handles. Richard finally figured out what Gratch meant. "No, no, that's not the same woman. It's a different person." Gratch frowned. He didn't understand. Richard didn't feel like trying to explain that the lock of hair he was always looking at was not from Pasha. At Gratch's urging, Richard instead wrestled with his woolly friend. It was twilight when Richard made it back to the palace. He was going to have to find Pasha and explain to her that Gratch was his friend and not a dangerous beast. Before he had gone far, Sister Verna found him instead.
"Did you feed that baby Gar back in the wilds, the one I told you to kill? Did you let that beast follow us?"
Richard stared at her. "It was helpless, sister. I couldn't kill something that was no harm to me. We've become friends." Muttering, she wiped a hand across her face.
"As absurd as it sounds, I suppose I can understand. You needed companionship, and you certainly didn't want it from me."
"Sister Verna."
"But why would you let Pasha see it?"
"I didn't. He just popped his head up. I didn't know he was there. Pasha saw him before I knew."
She let out an exasperated sigh. "The people around here fear beasts. They kill them. Pasha went screaming to the sisters that there was a beast in the hills."
"I'll explain it to them. I'll make them understand."
"Richard, listen to me."
He backed away a step and stood silently while he waited for her to go on.
"The palace believes that pets are a hindrance to learning to use your Han. They believe it diverts feelings away from them, to the creature. I think they are being foolish, but that is beside the point."
"What is the point? You mean they will try to keep me from seeing him anymore?"
She put an impatient hand on his arm. "No, Richard. They think it's a vile beast that could turn on you. They think you are in danger. The sisters are forming a search party as we speak. They intend to hunt it down and kill it for your own good."
Richard stared at her concerned expression for only a second, and then he was running. He charged over the bridge and back into the city. People gaped as he flew past. He leapt over carts that wouldn't move out of the way fast enough. He knocked over a stand selling amulets. People hollered at him, but he ran on. His heart thumped in his ears as he raced up the hills. Several times he stumbled over ditches or rocks, but he rolled to his feet, gasping for air, and rushed on. In the darkness, he leapt from rock to rock as he crossed ravines. At the crest of a round-topped hill, near where he had been with Gratch earlier, he yelled, between panting. His fists at his sides, he tipped his head back and screamed Gratch's name. His voice echoed off the surrounding hills. Only silence answered when the echoes died out. Exhausted, Richard fell to his knees. They would be coming soon. The sisters would use their Han to find the Gar. Gratch wouldn't know what they intended. Even if he kept his distance, their magic could reach out and kill him. They could knock him from the air or set him afire.
"Gratch! Gratch!"
A dark shape blackened a patch of stars. The Gar thumped to the ground and folded his wings. He cocked his head and gave a purling gurgle. Richard grabbed Gratch's fur in his fists.
"Gratch, listen to me. You have to go away. You can't stay here any longer. They're coming to kill you. You must leave."
Gratch let out a questioning whine that rose in pitch. His ears perked forward. He tried to put his arms around Richard. Richard pushed him away.
"Go. You understand me? I know you do. Go. I want you to go away. They will try to kill you. Go away and never come back."
Gratch's ears wilted as he cocked his head to the other side. Richard pounded a fist to the Gar's chest. He pointed north.
"Go away!"
He threw his arms out and pointed again. "I want you to go away and never come back." Gratch tried to put his arms around Richard again. Richard pushed them away again. Gratch's ears lay down against his head.
"Gratch! Log! Gratcherg!"
Richard wanted more than anything else to hold his friend and tell him that he loved him too, but he couldn't. He had to make him go in order to save his life.
"Well, I don't love you. Go away and never come back."
Gratch looked to the hill Pasha had run down. He looked back at Richard. His green eyes were filling with tears. He reached out for Richard. Richard shoved him away. Gratch stood with his arms out. Richard remembered the first time he had held the furry beast. He had been so little then. He was so big now. But as he had grown, his friendship and his love had grown, too. He was Richard's only friend, and only Richard could save him. If Richard really loved him, he had to do this.
"Go away. I don't want you around anymore. I don't want you to ever come back. You are just a big, dumb bag of fur. Go away. If you really love me, then you'll do as I ask and go away."
Richard wanted to keep yelling, but the lump in his throat caught the words. He backed away. Gratch seemed to wither in the cool night air. His arms came out again with a pitiful, forlorn wail. He called with a plaintive, keening cry. Richard took another step back. Gratch took a step toward him. Richard picked up a rock and heaved it at the Gar. It bounced off his huge chest.
"Go away!"
Richard cried. He threw another rock.
"I don't want you around anymore. Go away. I don't want to ever see you again."
Tears ran from the glowing green eyes over the wrinkles of his cheeks.
"Gratch, log, Gratchark.
If you really love me, then you will do this. Go."
The Gar looked again to the hill Pasha had run down, turned, and spread his wings. With a last look over his shoulder, he bounded into the air and flew off into the night. When he could no longer see the dark shape against the stars or hear the sweep of wings, Richard crumpled to the ground. His only friend was gone.
"I love you too, Gratch,"
he cried in racking sobs.
"Dear spirits, why have you done this to me? He was all I had. I hate you, every last one of you."
He was halfway back when it hit him. He froze in his tracks, his mouth hanging open. In the stillness of the night, his shaking fingers reached to his pocket. The lights of the city flickered in the near distance. Rooftops shimmered in the moonlight.
distant sounds of the city drifted out to him at the edge of the hills. He pulled out the lock of Kaylin's hair. "If you really love me," she had said, "you will do this." That was what he had told Gratch. In a flash of understanding, it all came to him. The jolt of comprehension took his breath. Kaylin had not been sending him away. She had been saving his life. She had done for him what he had just done for Gratch. The pain of having doubted her took him to his knees. It must have broken her heart. How could he have doubted her? The collar. He had been so afraid of the collar, he had been blinded to it. She loved him. She didn't want to be set free. She wanted only to save his life. She loved him. He threw his arms open and turned his face up to the sky. "She loves me!" He knelt, staring at the lock of hair she had given him to remind him of her love. In his whole life, he had never felt a sense of relief this great. The world came back to life for him. Richard's mind swirled in a confusion of conflicting emotions. He felt heartsick that he had sent Gratch away, that Gratch thought Richard didn't want him around anymore, but at the same time he felt overwhelming joy that Kaylin loved him. In the end, joy won out. He decided that someday Gratch might come to understand, as he had, that it had been necessary. Someday he would have the collar off, and he would find Gratch and make it up to him. And even if he didn't, the Gar was better off living as a Gar should, hunting and searching out its own kind. It would come to have its own happiness, as had Richard. Although he wanted more than anything to throw his arms around Kaylin, hug her tight and tell her how much he loved her, he couldn't. He was still a prisoner of the sisters, but he would study and learn and get the collar off. He would get the collar off and return to Kaylin. He knew without a doubt that she would be waiting for him. She had said she would always love him. When he met the search party of sisters at the edge of Tanimura, he told them that they needn't bother, that they would find the beast gone. They didn't believe him and went on into the hills. Richard didn't care. Gratch was gone. His friend was safe. Richard bought a gold necklace from a street hawker. He didn't know if it was real gold, but he didn't care. It looked pretty. He trotted the rest of the way to the palace. Pasha was pacing up and down in the hall outside his room.
"Richard, Richard, I was so worried. I know that right now you're furious with me, but in time you will see that..."
He grinned. "I'm not angry, Pasha. In fact, I brought you a present to thank you." She smiled in coy surprise as he offered her the necklace.
"For me? Why?"
"Because of you, I figured out that she loves me and always has. I was just being a blind fool. You helped me see that." She regarded him with a frosty look.
"But you are here now, Richard. You will forget her in time. You'll see that I'm the one for you."
He smiled happily at her. "Pasha, I'm sorry. It's nothing against you. You're a beautiful young woman. In time, you'll find the one for you. You can have your pick of nearly any man. Everyone likes you. But I'm not the one for you. Maybe if I live to be 100, but short of that..." Her sly smile returned.
"Then I will wait."
He kissed the top of her head before going through the door. He didn't think he would be able to sleep while he was this excited, but all the walking and running had left him exhausted. His last thoughts before he drifted off were of Kaylin. He pictured her in his mind, as if she was there with him, her special smile, her deep green eyes, and her radiant long hair. He drifted into the best sleep he had had in months. In the days following, Richard felt as if his feet hardly touched the ground. Everyone was puzzled by his good mood. They frowned at him at first, but were eventually caught up in his cheer. Some of the sisters giggled when he told them they looked as beautiful as a sunny day. He urged the sisters who came to practice with him to try harder, to help him to reach his Han. He had them stay longer than usual. Sisters Tovi and Cecilia bubbled with enthusiasm. Marissa and Nikki bestowed small smiles of pleasure. Armina was cautiously pleased, and Liliana delighted. He wanted this collar off, and until he could do what they wanted, he knew it would stay on. Having not seen Warren in a while, he finally went down to the vaults to see how his search was coming. Sister Becky was off retching, and the other sister giggled when he winked at her. Warren was pleasantly surprised to see him and exhilarated about some of the things he had found. He could hardly wait to tell Richard. When the door to one of the back rooms had grated closed, he started opening volumes on the table.
"What you told me has been of great help. Look here."
Warren pointed at words Richard couldn't understand.
"Just like you told me. This says that the Stone of Tears being in this world in itself does not free the keeper."
"So what significance does it have?"
"Well, it's as if there are a number of locks on his prison door, and this turns the key in one, but it does not free him. There are a number of ways for it to help him, a number of objects of magic to help. But the Stone of Tears itself must be used by one from this world, one with the gift for both additive and subtractive magic to free the keeper. Those with only the gift of additive can cause harm, tear the veil more, but not free him with it."
"I think," Warren said with a twinkle, "that we're safe with that black stone in this world as long as we're careful."
"It's not black. I never told you it was black. I just described the shape and size."
Warren touched a finger to his lower lip.
"Not black? Then what color is it?"
"Amber."
Warren slapped his hands to his chest with a groan of relief.
"Thank the Creator!"
He let out an uncharacteristic whoop.
"That's the best news I've heard all year. Amber means it was touched by a wizard's tears. That repulses the keeper. It's like rotten, festering meat would be to us. His agents won't touch it."
Richard's grin widened. It had to be Zed who had done it. That was why he felt Zed's pull from the stone. This, on top of his discovery about Kaelin, was just too much. He couldn't keep the happiness to himself.
"Warren, I have other good news. I'm in love. I'm going to be wed."
Warren gave another whoop, but then his smile wilted.
"It's not Pasha, is it? If it is, that's all right. I will understand. You two will make a handsome..."
Richard lightly touched Warren's shoulder.
"No, it's not Pasha. I'll tell you about her some other time. She's the mother confessor. I didn't mean to interrupt you. What about the other things?"
"Well..."
He pulled another book across the table. "There are precious few references to the round bone you spoke of, and the skrin. One of them is in a forked prophecy having to do with the winter solstice coming up in a couple of weeks. It's a complicated juncture of forks and crossovers. We've only recently learned that the prophecy about that woman and her people is the descendant of a true fork."
Whenever Warren went off on his talk of forks and junctures, Richard always started getting lost. About the only thing he understood was winter solstice.
"What does the winter solstice have to do with anything?"
Warren looked up.
"Winter solstice, the shortest day of the year. Shortest day, longest night. See what I mean?"
"No. What does that have to do with the skrin?"
"The longest night of the year. Longest night, most darkness. You see, the keeper has certain times when he can exert greater or lesser influence in this world. His is the world of darkness, and when we are in a period of the longest darkness, the veil is at its weakest. That's when he is able to do the most harm."
"Then we're in danger in a few weeks, at winter solstice."
Warren's eyebrows lifted in delight.
"Yes, but you've given me the information to solve an upcoming prophecy, along with what we now know to be the true fork involved along with it. You see, with the winter solstice, there is a prophecy about the danger to the world of the living. The keeper has to have a number of elements in place for it to be a true fork, such as an open gateway, but he needs an agent in this world."
Warren leaned forward in delight.
"And he in turn needs the skrin. If he has the skrin bone you told me of, he can invoke the guardian and destroy it. If the guardian is destroyed, the keeper can come through the gateway."
"Warren, that sounds pretty frightening to me."
Warren lifted his hand with a dismissive wave.
"No, no. Many prophecies sound ominous like this one, but the elements are rarely all in place, so they turn out to be false forks, as most do. The books are clogged with false forks because..."
"Warren, get to the point."
"Oh, yes. Well, you see, you told me that your friend has the bone that can invoke the skrin, and the keeper would need an agent, but he doesn't have one. Without the skrin bone, and with the upcoming fork, which we know must be passed correctly... And we think it will. This is just another false fork, so we're safe."
Richard felt a distant tingling of apprehension, but Warren's bubbly confidence overwhelmed it. He was caught up in Warren's enthusiasm. He gave the young man a clap on the back.
"Good work, Warren. Now I can concentrate on learning to use my Han."
Warren beamed.
"Thank you, Richard. I'm so glad you've been able to help me. I've made more progress than I ever thought I would before I met you."
Still grinning, Richard shook his head in wonder.
"Warren, I've never met anyone that was so smart yet so young."
Warren laughed, as if that was the funniest thing he had ever heard.
"What's so funny?" Your joke,
Warren said, wiping tears from his eyes. What joke? Warren's laughter slowed to a frowning chuckle.
About me being young. It was funny.
Richard held his polite smile.
Warren, why is that funny?
Warren's chuckle died down to a grin.
Because I'm 157 years old.
Richard's flesh prickled.
Now you're making a joke.
That's a joke.
It's a joke, Warren, isn't it?
Warren's good humor evaporated. He blinked.
Richard, you do know, don't you? They must have told you. I was sure they would have told you by now.
Richard's arms swept the books aside. He scooted his chair closer.
Told me what? Warren, don't you say something like that and then go silent on me. You're my friend. You tell me.
Warren cleared his throat and then wet his lips with his tongue. He leaned in a little.
Richard, I'm sorry. I thought you knew, or I would have told you myself a long time ago. I would have.
Told me what?
The magic. The magic of the Palace of the Prophets. It has additive and subtractive elements to it that are tied to the other worlds. That makes time move differently here.
Warren,
Richard said hoarsely, do you mean it affects all of us? All those wearing the collar?
No, everyone at the palace, the sisters too. This place is spelled. As long as the sisters live at the palace, they age the same as we do. The spell makes us age more slowly, makes time seem different to us.
What do you mean, different?
The spell slows our aging process. For every year we age, those outside age between 10 and 15 years.
Richard's head was spinning.
Warren, that can't be true. It can't.
He tried desperately to think of proof.
Pasha could only be... Richard, I've known Pasha for over 100 years.
Richard slid the chair back and stood. He raked his fingers through his hair.
That doesn't make any sense.
It has to be some kind of... Why would it work like that?
Warren took Richard's arm and sat him down. He pulled his own chair close. He spoke in a soft, concerned voice, as one would when breaking calamitous news to someone.
It takes a long time to train a wizard. Outside in the rest of the world, over 20 years had gone by before I was even able to touch my Han. But because I live here, I had aged less than 2 years. 20 years had passed here, too. But I had aged only 2. If the palace didn't slow our aging, we would all die of old age before we could even light a lamp with our Han. I have never heard of it taking less than 200 years to train a wizard. Commonly, it takes near to 300 and sometimes even as much as 400. The wizards who created this place knew that, and so they tied the magic here to the worlds beyond, where time is meaningless. I don't know how it works, just that it does.
Richard's hand shook.
But I have to get this collar off. I have to get to Kaelin. I can't wait that long. Warren, help me. I can't wait that long.
Warren glanced to the floor.
I'm sorry, Richard. I don't know how to get our collars off, and I don't know how to get by the barrier that keeps us here. I know how you feel, though. It drove me into the vaults for the last 50 years. Some of the others don't seem to care and say it just gives them more time with women.
Richard slowly rose.
I can't believe it.
Warren turned his face up.
Richard, please forgive me for telling you. I'm sorry I was the one to hurt you. You've always been...
Richard put a hand to Warren's shoulder.
It's not your fault. You didn't do it. You simply told me the truth.
His voice felt as if it were coming from the bottom of a well.
Thank you for the truth, my friend.
All he could think, as his feet shuffled toward the door, was that his dreams were all dying. If he couldn't get the collar off, everything would be lost. Sisters Eulicia and Fenella both stood in warning as he came through the doors. They backed away the same as the guards had, when they saw the look on his face. A sparkling shield went up before the door. He went through it without slowing. The door beyond burst open for him without him touching it, part of the frame splintering. It somehow never occurred to him to use the knob. The prelate was sitting with her hands folded on the heavy walnut table. Her solemn eyes watched him come. Richard pressed up against the table, towering over her.
"I must admit, Richard," she said in a somber tone, "that I have not been looking forward to this visit."
His straining voice broke.
"Why didn't Sister Verna tell me?"
"I ordered her not to."
"And why did you not tell me?"
because I wanted you first to learn some significant things about yourself, so you would be better able to understand your importance. The burden of a wizard, and of a prelate, too.
Richard sank to his knees before her desk.
Anne, he whispered, please help me. I must have the Radahan off. I love Kaelin. I need her. I need to get back to her. I've been gone a long time. Please, Anne, help me. Take the collar off.
She closed her eyes for a long moment. When they opened, they were heavy with regret.
I spoke the truth, Richard. We cannot get the Radahan off until you learn enough to help us. That will take time.
Please, Anne, help me. Isn't there any other way? Slowly, her eyes staying on his, she shook her head.
No, Richard. Over time, you will come to accept it. They all do. It is easier for the rest, because they have come here as boys, not understanding, and grasp it only over time. We have never had to tell one grown like you who could understand the significance.
Richard couldn't make himself think clearly. It felt as if he were stumbling in a dark dream.
But we'll lose so much time together. She will be old. Everyone I know will be old.
Anne smoothed her hair back as she averted her eyes.
Richard, by the time you are trained and leave here, the great-great-great-grandchildren of everyone you know will have died of old age and been buried in the ground for over 100 years.
He blinked at her, trying to comprehend the math of the generations involved. But it all turned to mush in his mind. He suddenly remembered what Shota had warned him of. A trap in time. This was that trap. He had been stripped of everything by these people. Everything he loved was gone. He would never see Zed again, or Chase, or anyone he knew. He would never hold Kaelin again. He would never be able to tell her that he loved her, that he understood the sacrifice she had made for him.
Chapter 63. Richard looked up from where he sat on the floor to see Warren in the doorway. He hadn't heard the knock. When he said nothing, Warren rushed over and squatted down beside him.
Listen, Richard, something you said made me think. You said that you were going to wed the Mother Confessor.
Richard's mind came out of the daze, and his eyes suddenly came up. The prophecy is about her, isn't it? The prophecy you said would come on winter solstice.
I think it might be, but I don't know enough about her, about confessors, to tell. Does the Mother Confessor wear white?
Yes, the confessors are born to find the truth. She is the last one.
Richard, I think that is good news. I think she is to find happiness and bring it to her people on the winter solstice.
Richard remembered the vision he had had in the Tower of Perdition. He remembered the horror of what he had seen. The words Kaelin had spoken were burned into his memory. He quoted it to Warren. Of all there were, but a single one born of the magic to bring forth truth will remain alive when the shadow's threat is lifted. Therefore comes the greater darkness of the dead. For there to be a chance at life's bond, this one in white must be offered to her people to bring their joy and good cheer.
Yes, that's it. I believe that the greater darkness means both the Keeper and winter solstice. I think that means... Richard, where did you read that prophecy?
I didn't read it. It was brought to me in a vision of her. Warren's eyes grew big, the way they tended to when he was astonished.
You had a vision of prophecy?
Yes. She brought me the words, and also brought a vision of what it means.
What does it mean?
Richard brushed at his pant leg. I can't tell you. She said that I could speak the words, but not of the vision. I'm sorry, Warren, but I dare not violate that warning without knowing the consequences. But I can tell you that the results of this prophecy coming true would not be joyful for her or for me. Warren considered a moment.
Yes, you were right.
He looked over out of the corner of his eye.
Richard, there is something about prophecy I think I should tell you. Hardly anyone knows this, but the words don't always reflect the true intent.
What do you mean?
Well, a few times when I have read prophecies, I've had a vision. The vision turns out to be true, and so does the prophecy, but not in the way you would think from reading it. I believe that the true way prophecy is meant to be understood is through the gift, through the visions.
Do the sisters know this?
No.
I think this is what it means to be a prophet. Richard, if you had this vision and heard the words and saw the meaning, maybe that means you are a prophet.
According to the prelate, I have a different talent. If she is right, then having the vision might just be part of my ability for what I truly am.
Which is?
The prelate said, I'm a war wizard. His eyes widened again.
Richard, war wizards have the gift for both magics. None with the gift for subtractive two has been born in thousands of years. Maybe the prelate is wrong.
I hope she is, but it would explain some things. From what a friend of mine told me, additive magic is using what is, adding to it, multiplying it, altering it, the doing of things. Subtractive magic is the counter, the undoing of things. All the shields are put up by the sisters. They have only additive. Even those with the gift cannot easily go through them or break them, because they also have only additive. Power against power. But somehow I'm able to walk right through the shields around here without even trying. Subtractive magic would explain that. Subtractive would counter the additive of the shields, undo it.
But you said you tried to go through the barrier that keeps us from leaving. That's a shield, too. Why can't you go through that shield, then, if you really have the subtractive?
Richard lifted an eyebrow and leaned in. Warren, who put those shields in place?
Well, the ones who placed the rest of the magic of the palace, the wizards of old,
who you said had subtractive magic. That shield is the only one placed by them. It's the only one I can't go through. It's the only one my subtractive magic, if I truly have it, wouldn't counter. See what I mean?
Warren sat back on his heels.
Yes. He rubbed his chin as he thought.
Well, that would make sense. It might fit with some of the prophecies about you. If you really are a war wizard,
and are the one born true. And do these prophecies say, I will prevail? Warren hesitated. He glanced over at the Sword of Truth lying on the floor nearby.
If I said, white blade, would that mean anything to you?
Richard let out a heavy breath at the memory. I can turn the blade of my sword white through magic. Warren wiped his hand over his face.
Then I think we might be in trouble. There is a prophecy that says, should the forces of forfeit be loosed, the world will be shadowed yet by darker lust through what has been rent. Salvation's hope, then, will be as slim as the white blade of the one born true.
Through what has been rent, the open gateway, Richard said.
That would make the darker lust be the keeper.
Warren, I have to do something about the prophecy. The one about the one in white. It's important. Do you have any ideas?
Warren watched him as if trying to decide something. I do. I don't know if it will help.
He put weight on his hands as he rubbed them on his thighs.
They have a prophet here at the palace. I've never seen him. I want to, but they won't let me. They say it's too dangerous for me to talk to him until I learn more. They promise that when I learn enough, they will let me talk with him.
Here in the palace? Where?
Warren pulled a fold of his robes from under his knees. I don't know. It would have to be one of the restricted areas, but I don't know which one, and I don't know how we can find out.
Richard stood. I do. Richard knew he had gone to the right guard when swordsman Kevin Andelmere turned white as a spirit at the mention of the prophet. He was reluctant, feigning ignorance at first, but when Richard gently reminded him of all the favors, Kevin whispered the location. The compound Kevin had divulged was one of the most heavily guarded. Richard knew where all the guards were stationed because he had gathered white roses there and had been up on the wall to look out at the sea. He also knew all the guards. They were frequent visitors to the prostitutes he provided. He didn't slow at the outer gate, but simply gave a nod to the wink the guards gave him. The guards at the rampart were considerably more reticent, stammering and holding out a hand to halt him. He shook the hand, pretending that he had thought that was what was meant by it. They finally sighed and resumed their post as he marched away, his Mrizwith cape billowing open. At the end of the rampart was a small colonnade, and at the end of that, winding stairs that led down to the prophet's quarters. The guards at the door he wanted were the two he had had trouble winning over at first, and the first to receive his gift of female company. They stiffened when they saw him. Richard casually made for the door between them. Walsh? Boylston? How are you doing? They crossed their pikes over the door. Richard, what are you doing down here? The roses grow up top. Look, Walsh, I have to go see the prophet. Richard, don't put us in this spot. You know we can't let you in. The sisters would skin us alive. Richard shrugged. I won't tell them you let me in. I'll say I tricked you. If anyone finds out, which they won't, just tell them I snuck by and you didn't know until I was on my way out. I'll back your story. Richard, you're really... Have I ever done anything to cause trouble? Have I ever done anything but help all you men? I buy you drinks, I loan you money when you need it, I let you have free access to the girls, and it never costs you a copper. Have I ever asked for anything in return? Richard had his hand on the hilt of the sword. One way or another, he was going through that door. Walsh pushed a stone chip with his boot. With a heavy sigh, first one, and then the other, pulled their pikes up. Boylston, go make your rounds. I'm going to the privy for a sit. Richard took his hand from the sword and gave the man a pat on the shoulder. Thanks, Walsh. I appreciate it. Halfway down the inner hall, Richard felt layers of resistance, shields like the ones that were outside the prelate's door. But they only slowed him a bit. The room inside was as spacious as his own, but perhaps more elegantly appointed. One wall held large tapestries and another expansive bookshelves. Most of the books, though, seemed to be scattered about the room on chairs and couches and covering the blue and yellow carpets on the floor. Richard could see the back of a man in the chair beside the cold hearth. "You must tell me how you do that," the man said in a deep, powerful voice. "I would be most interested in learning the trick." "Do what?" Richard asked. "Walk through shields as if they weren't there. Burns the flesh right off me when I try." "If I ever figure it out myself, I'll let you know. My name is Richard. If you're not busy, I would like to speak with you."
"Busy?"
The man's shoulders shook with his hearty laugh. When he stood, Richard was a little surprised at how big he was. His long white hair had made Richard think he might be old and shriveled. Old he was. Shriveled he was not. He looked strong and full of vitality. His smile was welcoming and threatening at the same time. He wore a Radahan, the same as Richard.
"My name is Nathan, Richard. I've been looking forward to meeting you. I didn't expect you would find your way in alone."
"I wanted to come alone so we could talk freely."
"And do you know that I am a prophet?"
"I didn't come here to learn to bake bread."
Nathan's smile widened, but he didn't laugh. His brows pulled together like a hawk's. His voice took on a hiss. "Would you like me to tell you of your death, Richard? How you are going to die?"
Richard flopped down on the couch and plunked his feet up on a table. He returned the hawk-like glare and threatening smile in kind.
"Sure, I'd love to hear all about it. And then when you're done, I will tell you how you are going to die."
Nathan lifted an eyebrow.
"And are you a prophet?"
"Enough of one to tell you how you are to die."
The frown turned curious. "Really? Tell me then."
Richard took a pear from a bowl on the table, polished it on his pant leg, and took a bite. He spoke as he chewed.
"You are going to die right here, in these rooms of old age, without ever seeing the outside world again."
The creases in Nathan's face deepened as his expression sagged.
"Seems you are a prophet, my boy.
Unless you help me. Maybe if you help me, I'll be able to come back here and help you get out, too."
"And what is it you want?"
"I want this collar off." A sly grin spread on Nathan's face.
"Seems we share a common interest, Richard."
"But the sisters say I will die without it."
The sly grin widened. "They demand truthfulness from others, but rarely inconvenience themselves with it. The sisters have their own agenda, Richard. There is more than one path through the woods."
"The sisters say I must learn to use my Han in order to get it off. They don't seem to be helping much in that."
"It would be easier to teach a stump to sing than for a mere sister to teach you to use your Han. You have subtractive magic. They can't help you."
"Can you help me, Nathan?"
"Perhaps."
Nathan sat down in his chair, leaning forward intently.
"Tell me, Richard,
Have you ever read The Adventures of Bonnie Day?
Read it? It's my favorite book. I read it until my eyes nearly wore the words off the page. I'd love to meet the person who wrote it and tell him how much I like the book.
A broad, childlike grin stole onto Nathan's face. You just have, my boy, you just have.
Richard came forward from the back of the couch.
You? You wrote The Adventures of Bonnie Day?
Nathan quoted a few passages to prove his intimate knowledge.
I gave the book to your father to give to you when you were old enough to read. You were just born at the time.
You were there with the prelate? She didn't tell me that.
I doubt the truth occurred to her. You see, Anne doesn't have the power to get into the wizard's keep in Adendrill. I helped George get in, so he could get the Book of Counted Shadows. They have some very interesting books of prophecy there.
Richard stared in astonishment.
Seems we are old acquaintances, then. More than acquaintances, Richard Rawl.
Nathan gave him a meaningful look.
My name is Nathan Rawl.
Richard's mouth dropped open.
You are my great-great-something or other?
Too many greats to count. I am nearly 1,000 years old, my boy.
He waggled a finger in the air.
I have had an interest in you for a long time. You are in the prophecies. I wrote The Adventures of Bonnie Day for some of those who had potential. It is a book of prophecy of sorts, a primer of prophecy, one you would be able to understand. So it would help you. It did help you, didn't it?
More than once, Richard said, still having trouble keeping his jaw up.
Good. I'm pleased, then. We gave the book to a few special boys. You are the only one still alive. The rest died in inexplicable accidents.
Richard finished the pair while he thought. He definitely didn't like the part about subtractive magic.
So can you help me with using my power?
Think, Richard. The sisters have not given you pain with a collar, have they?
No, but they will.
Fighting the last war, Richard. What did Bonnie Day tell the Warwick troops guarding the moors? That the enemy would not come the same way as they had before? That they were foolishly wasting their energy trying to fight the last war?
Nathan lifted an eyebrow.
You seem to have missed the lesson. Just because something happened to you before, that does not mean it will happen again. Think ahead, Richard, not behind.
Richard hesitated.
I had a vision in one of the towers, a vision that Sister Verna used the collar to hurt me.
And it brought the anger forth.
Richard nodded. I called the magic and killed her. Nathan gave a small, disappointed shake of his head.
The vision was your own mind trying to tell you something, trying to show you that you could defend yourself if they did that, that you could defeat them. It was your gift and your mind working together trying to help you. You were too busy fighting the last war to heed the message.
Chagrined, Richard kept his mouth shut. He had worried about them hurting him to the exclusion of everything else. He had ignored the true meaning of what Kaelin had done because he had been so afraid of the past coming to life again.
Think of the solution, not the problem. That was what Zed had taught him. He had been blinded to the future by the past.
I see what you mean, Nathan, he admitted. What did you mean about the sisters not giving me pain with a collar?
Anne knows you are a war wizard. I told her before you were born. I told her near to 500 years ago. She would have given orders to the sisters. Giving pain to a war wizard is like kicking a badger on his rump.
You mean that pain is somehow the secret to my power?
No. The result of pain. Anger.
He gestured to the sword at Richard's hip.
You use the sword in that way. Anger calls forth the magic. Actually, you call the magic. It brings you anger, and so the magic works. Would you like me to show you how to touch your Han?
Richard scooted forward.
Yes! I never thought I would say that, but yes, I need to be able to get out of here.
Hold up your palm.
Good.
He seemed to pull an aura of authority around himself.
Now lose yourself in my eyes.
Richard stared into the hooded, deep, dark azure eyes. The gaze drew him in. Richard felt as if he were falling up into the clear blue sky. His breath came in ragged pulls, not of his own will. He felt Nathan's commanding words more than heard them.
Call forth the anger, Richard. Call forth the rage. Call forth the hate and fury.
Richard felt it, just as when he drew the sword. As he felt his breath being drawn for him, he felt the anger being drawn.
Now feel the heat of that rage. Feel the flames of it. Good. Now focus those feelings in the palm of your hand.
Richard funneled the rage of the magic to his hand, directed its flow, feeling its force, his teeth gritted with the power of it.
Look in your hand, Richard. See it there. See what you are feeling.
Richard's eyes slowly moved to his hand. A ball of blue and yellow fire tumbled slowly above his outstretched palm. He could feel the energy flowing from himself into the fire. He increased the flow of rage and the angry ball of flame grew.
Now cast the rage, the hate, the anger, the fire at the hearth.
Richard threw his hand out. The slowly tumbling sphere of flame stayed with his hand. He looked to the hearth, focusing the rage outward, casting it away from himself. The liquid light howled as it streaked to the hearth, exploding there with a crack, like lightning. Nathan smiled with pride.
That is how it's done, my boy. I doubt the sisters could teach you that in 100 years. You're a natural, no doubt about it. You are a war wizard.
But, Nathan, I didn't feel my Han. I didn't sense anything different. All I felt was angry, like when I used the sword. For that matter, like when I shut my finger in a door.
Nathan nodded knowingly.
Of course not. You are a war wizard. Others have only one side of the gift. They use what is around them, the air, heat, cold, fire, water, whatever they need. War wizards aren't like others. They instead tap the core of power within themselves. You don't direct your Han, you direct your feelings. The sisters teach the how of how everything is done. That is irrelevant to your power. For you, results are all that are important, because you draw power from within. That is why the sisters cannot teach you.
What do you mean, that's why they cannot teach me?
Have you ever seen a seamstress miss a pincushion? The sisters want you to watch your hand, the pin, and the pincushion. That's the way other wizards use their magic. War wizards don't watch. They just do. Their Han acts instinctively.
Was that wizard's fire?
Nathan chuckled.
That was to wizard's fire. What an annoyed moth is to an enraged bull.
Richard tried again, but the fire wouldn't come. The anger wouldn't come. He could draw the sword's anger, but it wasn't the same kind he had done with Nathan, from within himself.
It won't work. Why can't I do it again?
Because I was helping you, showing you with my own power what it's like. You are not yet able to do it on your own.
Why?
Nathan reached over and tapped Richard's head.
Because it must come from in here. You have yet to accept yourself who you are. You don't believe. You still fight who you are. Until you accept yourself, until you believe, you won't be able to call forth your Han, your power, except in great anger.
One of the headaches that came from my gift, the sisters said they would kill me without the collar.
The sisters nibble around the truth as if it were gristle in a piece of meat. They only eat it if they're starving. They want us prisoners so they can bring us to their ways. What they attempt to do when they train with you is what I have just done. The headaches are dangerous, but only if a young wizard is left alone with his power. When you had the headaches, were you ever able to make them go away?
Yes, sometimes when I concentrated on shooting arrows, or when something inside me warned of danger, or when I was angry and used the magic of the sword. Then they went away for a time.
That's because you were bringing the gift into harmony with your mind. The only thing required to keep the gift from harming you is a bit of instruction, like I just gave you. Teaching wizards should be a wizard's business. For a wizard, bringing your mind into harmony with your gift is a simple matter, because it's the male gift teaching the male gift. What I have just done with you is enough to keep the gift from harming you for a good long time, without the Radahan. In the future, joining with a wizard will take you the next step and protect you until you reach the following plane. It's only important to have help available when you need it. The sisters need 100 years to show you what I have just done. They use the collar as an excuse to take us prisoner for their own purposes. They have their own ideas about the training of wizards. Their idea is to control wizards.
Why?
They think wizards are responsible for all the evil that has befallen mankind. And if they collar the power, control it, and indoctrinate it, they will bring the light of their theology to the people. They are zealots who believe they are the only ones who know the true way to eternal reward in the Creator's light. They feel justified in using any means to gain that end.
You mean that what you have just shown me with my power is enough to keep the gift from killing me without the collar?
It's enough to keep the gift from killing you, but it would take many more lessons to teach you to be a real wizard. All I have done is hold the stallion's bit so he won't buck you off. It would take much more work to teach you to ride with grace.
Richard could feel the muscles in his face draw tight.
If this is true, then they are kicking the rump of a badger.
Thank you for helping me. Richard rubbed his fingers together. Nathan, there is great trouble coming very soon. I need to know a few things. Do you know the wizard's second rule?
Of course. But you must learn the first before you have the second.
I already know the first. I killed Darken Rull with the first. It states that people can be made to believe any lie, either because they want to believe it's true or because they are afraid it's true.
And the counter to it?
The secret is that there is no counter. I must be always vigilant, knowing that I too am vulnerable and never arrogantly believe I am immune. I must always be alert that I can fall prey.
Very good.
And the second rule?
Nathan's white eyebrows hooded his azure eyes. The second rule involves unintended results.
So what is it?
The second rule is that the greatest harm can result from the best intentions. It sounds a paradox, but kindness and good intentions can be an insidious path to destruction. Sometimes doing what seems right is wrong and can cause harm. The only counter to it is knowledge, wisdom, forethought, and understanding the first rule. Even then, that is not always enough.
Good intentions or doing right can cause harm, such as?
Nathan shrugged. It would seem kind to give candy to a small child because they like it so. Knowledge, wisdom, and forethought tell us that it would make the child sick if we continued this kindness at the expense of good food.
That's obvious. Anyone would know that.
Say a person hurts their leg and you bring them food while they heal, but after time, they still don't wish to get up because it hurts at first. So you continue to be kind and bring them food. Over time, their legs will shrivel, and it will be even more painful to get up. So you are kind and continue bringing food. In the end, they will be bedridden, unable to ever walk again because of your kindness. Your good intentions have brought harm.
I don't think that happens often enough to be a problem.
I'm trying to give you obvious examples, Richard, so you will be better able to extrapolate to more difficult problems and understand an obscure principle. Good intentions, being kind, can encourage the lazy and motivate sound minds to become indolent. The more help you give them, the more help they need. As long as your kindness is open-ended, they never gain discipline, dignity, or self-reliance. Your kindness impoverishes their humanity. If you give a coin to a beggar because he says his family is hungry, and he uses it to get drunk, then kills someone, is it your fault? No, he did the killing. But had you given him food instead or gone and given his family food, the killing would not have happened. It was a good intention that resulted in harm. Wizard's second rule. The greatest harm can result from the best intentions. Violation can cause anything from discomfort to disaster to death. Some leaders have preached peace, saying that even self-defense is wrong. It seems the best of intentions to shun violence. In the end, it often leads to a slaughter where their threat of violence in the beginning would have prevented attack and resulted in no violence. They put their good intentions above the realities of life. They accuse warriors of being bloodthirsty when the warriors would have actually prevented bloodshed. Are you trying to say I should feel no shame at being a war wizard? It does the sheep no good to preach the goodness of a diet of grass if the wolves are of a different mind. Richard felt as though he were having a conversation with Zed. But kindness can't always be wrong. Of course not. That's where wisdom comes in. You must be wise enough to foresee the consequences of your actions. But the problem with the second rule is that you can't always tell for sure whether you are violating it or simply doing right. Worse, magic is dangerous. When you add magic to the good intentions, violation of the second rule can lead to catastrophe. Using magic is easy. Knowing when to use magic is the hard part. Every time you use it, you can bring unexpected ruin. Do you know, Richard, that it's the weight of one flake of snow that is one too many and causes an avalanche? Without that one last flake, the catastrophe would not happen. When using magic, you must know which is the one snowflake too many before you add its weight. The avalanche will be out of all proportion to what you think the weight of that flake could invoke. Richard rubbed his thumb on the hilt of his sword. Nathan, I think I may have torn the veil because I violated the wizard's second rule.
You did.
What did I do?
You used your magic through the wizard's first rule to win. In so doing, you fed magic to the boxes, the gateway, tearing the veil. You did it through ignorance. You didn't know that the unintended results of doing what seemed right could be the destruction of all life. One snowflake indeed. Magic is dangerous.
How can I fix it?
The Stone of Tears must be put back on the keeper. The lock, the seal must be restored. The Stone of Tears must be sent back to its rightful place in the underworld, where it will serve to restrain the Keeper's power in this world. To do that requires both powers. The key must then be turned in the lock, so to speak, by closing the gateway. This also requires both magics. Doing any of this with only one side of the magic would rip the veil, so a wizard with the gift for only the additive such as myself would be of no help. Only one such as you can accomplish the task. Until it is done, we are in terrible danger. If you act wrongly, use the stone for your own reasons, you have the power to destroy the balance and tear the veil the rest of the way, sending us all into eternal night. Richard stared at the table while he thought.
Do you know what an agent is?
Ah. You must be talking about the trouble with the upcoming winter solstice. An agent is one who trades favors with the keeper. Favors such as the innocent souls of children in return for knowledge of the use of subtractive magic. He gave Richard a dark look. But that would not be a problem, because you sent Darkenrall to the underworld, where he has no power here. Darkenrall is in the underworld, is he not?
Richard felt a gnawing pain in the pit of his stomach.
He had not only torn the veil, but in violating the second rule again by trying to help with a gathering, he had brought an agent, Darkenrall, back to this world, where he could act to tear the veil. It was all Richard's fault. He felt hot and dizzy. He thought he might be sick at any moment.
Nathan, I have to get this collar off.
Nathan shrugged. I can't help with that.
Richard had come here for a specific reason. He decided he had to try to get the answer. He cleared his throat.
Nathan, there is someone very important to me. She is in danger, and I must help. There is a prophecy about her that is written down, but it also came to me in a vision.
Which prophecy?
Of all there were, but a single one born of the magic to bring forth truth will remain alive when the shadow's threat is lifted. In his deep, powerful voice, Nathan finished the prophecy.
Therefore comes the greater darkness of the dead. For there to be a chance at life's bond, this one in white must be offered to her people to bring their joy and good cheer.
Then you know of it. Nathan, I saw the meaning of the prophecy. I was told not to speak of the vision, but it's not a joyful outcome, as far as I'm concerned.
She is beheaded, Nathan said in a quiet voice. That is the true meaning of that prophecy.
Richard put his arm across his churning stomach. That was what he had seen in the vision. His world started spinning again. Nathan, I have to get away from here. I have to stop that from happening.
Richard, look at me. Richard looked up, managing to hold the tears back. Richard, I must tell you the truth. If this prophecy does not happen, there is nothing beyond. We all die. It will be the end of all life. The Keeper will have us. If you use your power to stop it, you will rip the veil asunder and allow the Keeper to swallow the world of the living.
Richard shot to his feet. Why? Why would she have to die to save the living? It makes no sense. His fist tightened around the hilt of the sword. I have to stop it. It's just a stupid riddle. I won't let her die for a riddle.
Richard, a time will come when you have to make a choice. I have been hoping for a very long time now that when that time comes, you will be wise enough to make the right choice. You have the power to destroy us all if you choose wrongly.
I will not stand here while you tell me I must let her die. The good spirits have done nothing to help. I must. I will.
Richard stormed from the room. Cracks ran along the walls beside him as he marched down the hall. Chunks of plaster rained down behind as he went. Richard only dimly noticed, but it pleased his temper. When he went through the shield, the paint on the walls to the side charred and curled. Richard's thoughts ran wildly in all directions at once. He knew now that his vision had been of what was going to happen if he didn't stop it. It was going to come true if he couldn't get away from the palace. Maybe that was what the prophecy meant, that he would be held prisoner there, and he wouldn't be able to help, and Kaelin would die. In the courtyard below, Richard saw a commotion. Guards were running from everywhere. When he got closer, he saw one of the Bakaban Mana blademasters. There had to be close to 100 worried-looking guards surrounding him in the ring, holding their distance. The man in loose-fitting clothes in the center of the ring looked unconcerned. Richard pushed through the throng. "What's going on?" The man bowed to Richard.
"Kaharan, I am Jayan. Your wife, Duchailu, has sent me to give you a message."
Richard decided not to contest the wife part. "What is it?"
"I am to tell you that she has followed her husband's instructions. We have brought the Majendai to peace with us. We no longer make war with them or the people here."
"That's wonderful news, Jayan. Tell her I am proud of her and her people."
"Your people," Jayan corrected. "She wants you to know she has decided to bear the child. And she also sends message that we are ready to return to our homeland. She wishes to know when you will come to take us there."
Richard glanced around at the people. Not only guards were gathered, but sisters too. He recognized a few of his teachers watching. Sisters Tovi, Nikki, and Armina. Pasha stood nearby. At the far edge of the crowd, he saw Sister Verna. On a balcony in the distance beyond the walls, he saw the squat figure of the prelate. Richard turned to Jayan. "Tell her to be ready, that it will be soon."
Jayan bowed. "Thank you, Kaharan. We will be ready."
Richard spoke to the guards in a circle around them. "This man has come in peace. He is to be left in peace." Jayan strode away, unconcerned, as if he were alone on a walk, but the ring of guards moved with him, as Richard knew they would until he was well clear of the city. The crowd started drifting away. Richard's head was pounding. He had brought his father back from the underworld by violating the wizard's second rule, a second time in the spirit house. He had tried to do the right thing and instead had brought harm. Warren had told him that the Keeper needed an agent to escape, and Richard had provided one. His mind reeled. He had just found out that Kaelin loved him and life seemed good again, only to discover that he was to be trapped here for hundreds of years, and if he couldn't escape, Kaelin would die on winter solstice. His thoughts went around and around in a desperate tangle. He had to do something. Time was running out. He decided to find the one person who might be able to help him. Chapter 64. She heard the voices in the outer office and hoped it was who she thought it would be.
She was not looking forward to this, but she was running out of time. Richard would have surely found a way to see Nathan by now, and Nathan would have done his part. Now it was time to do hers. She couldn't completely trust Nathan, but in this, he would have done what was required. He knew the consequences of failure. His had been a task she didn't envy, adding the weight of that snowflake. With a flick of her fingers, the door swung open. She had had to have the carpenters fix the doorframe. Richard had shattered it with his Han, without even being aware of what he had done. And that was before he had even gone to Nathan. The curt speech cut off as the door opened, and the three faces looked in, awaiting instruction. "Sister Yulisha, Fenella, it's late. Why don't you two run along to your offices and tend to your paperwork? I will see her. Sister Verna, please come in." Anne stood as Sister Verna strode in. She liked Verna. She abhorred what she was going to have to do to her, but she was running out of time. Hundreds of years to prepare, and now time and events were slipping through her fingers. The world was at the brink. Verna bowed. "Prelate Annalena." "Please, Verna, sit down. It has been so long." Verna pulled a chair close to the opposite side of the table. She sat with her back straight and her hands folded in her lap. "How good of you to take your valuable time to see me." Anne almost smiled. Almost. "Dear Creator, thank you for sending her to me, Testy. Though it won't make my job any less onerous, it will surely make it easier." "I have been busy."
"So have I," Verna snapped, "for the last 20-odd years."
"Apparently not busy enough. We seem to be having difficulty with the boy you collected, and should have brought to task before he ever arrived."
Verna's face turned scarlet. "Had you not forbidden me from doing my duty, using my skills, I would have done so."
"Oh. Are you so barren of resourcefulness, Verna, that you could not function with minor restrictions? Pasha, a mere novice, seems to be having better success, and she functions under the same restrictions."
"You think so? You think he is under control?"
"He has not killed anyone since Pasha took over."
Verna stiffened. "I think I know something of Richard. I would advise the prelate caution in her confidence."
Anne looked down, moving papers about, as if devoting attention to words she was not seeing. "I will take your advice under consideration. Thank you for coming, Verna."
"I'm not finished. I haven't yet begun."
Her eyes came slowly up. "If you raise your voice to me again, you will be, Verna."
"Prelate Annalena, please forgive my tone, but there are matters of grave importance I simply must raise."
Anne sighed, feigning impatience.
"Yes, yes, then.